Our agenda is here. Today on the agenda, we need to discuss Mark Luba has suggested that he be the liaison between IMS Global, which is a educational standards setting body, and the Post-Secondary Educational Standards Council. So we need to talk about that. We should also quickly bring up W3C TPAC. excuse me, most of the people in this group are going to be trying to go to W3C TPAC to raise the credentials issues in the web payments work. So we should talk a bit about that. We should talk about the vote on the charter, which was completed last Friday, and then go directly into web payments use cases and education and government use cases. Is there anything else that we should discuss today? Any other additions to the agenda? Okay, so the link to W3C TPAC is here. This is the registration form. It hasn't been announced publicly yet. It's been announced on a public mailing list that we're hoping to have the web payments. If the web payments technical work or the interest group is approved, and that's going to start being voted on, I think, towards the end of this month, and we won't know whether or not the work is approved until mid-October. We're expecting it to go through. I mean, there's a lot of organizations that have joined W3C specifically to do this work, so it's got a lot of support. Again, that's not an official statement of any kind. It's just we're seeing a lot of support for it. So the expectation is by October 15th, the work will be approved. And so on the Monday and Tuesday of W3C TPAC, that is when the web payments group is going to meet. We're meeting in the mornings and the afternoons on both days, and there's an open kind of ad hoc group meeting time from 11 to 3 on Monday and Tuesday, and I would imagine that the credentials group is going to meet during that time. So I think what we're planning on is, the use cases that we are working on in this group, we're going to try and get into some kind of stable document, and we're going to take that to W3C, the technical plenary, at the end of October, and we're going to talk about it in the web payments group, and then we can have breakout sessions based on the discussions that happen in the web payments group. And have a section that talks about credentials, not only for payments, but also government and education and things of that nature. So if you are interested in going to TPAC, it is going the meetings are going to be on Monday and Tuesday. So definitely be there Monday and Tuesday. If you can show up on Wednesday because that's the plenary day, it's really great to see kind of all the organizations at W3C get together and talk about the big issues for the web. And there's a huge gala dinner celebrating 25 years of the web that night, which is going to be should be fantastic. So Monday, Tuesday, and if you can Wednesday would be good to attend. We need to. Between now and the end of October, think about what topics we want to be addressed when it comes to credentials. For example, this group could say that this group could talk make a couple of statements to the web payments steering group to say that we think identity is not an optional thing for payments on the web. It is something that we absolutely need. And just have and say, education and government identity is a part of this. It's not just financial identity. It's a broader topic. And we have a group of organizations that are very interested in making that happen. Anyway, just a heads up to those that don't know about W3C TPAC going on. If you want to participate in the work, definitely register. If you're not a W3C member, that doesn't mean you can't go. It just means that you have to be cleared by W3C to attend. And there are a number of organizations that are going through this process right now. So, in general, if you want to go, let me know, and I will put you in touch with the right people at W3C to get you in the door and get you into those meetings.
So,
Any
sorry.
questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. So I'm involved with the community groups and the web items thing, but I'm not actually a member. So how would I go about it? You're going to send something out about that, or?
We'd basically talk to Stefan Boyera and Karen Myers at W3C and say that you've been, involved in this work for, multiple years now, and you're leading a lot of the work in the Asia Pacific region, so you should be able to attend as a as an invited expert.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I'll get you those. Ping me after the call so I can get you those contact information, the emails.
Cheers.
Okay. Any other questions on TPAC? Okay. Next up is Mark's liaison relationship to IMS Global and the Post-Secondary Educational Standards Council. Mark Luba, who's been on the call, unfortunately is not here today, said that he'd like to be the liaison to these two groups. For those that don't know, IMS Global sets a lot of the education standards, so things like LTI, the Learning Technology Integration Standard. Basically, a lot of learning management systems use LTI and the standards that IMS Global creates. IMS Global is looking for a way to do open credentials and more seamless login using those credentials. The Post-Secondary Educational Standards Council, I don't really have a lot of experience with, but I would imagine that they do what the title says, work on standards for post-secondary education. Marks has a history with them. He'd be a great person to be involved with those groups. We have spoken with IMS Global, and they are interested in participating in the work. So I guess this topic is mostly about if anybody has any objections or if anybody thinks that someone else would be better suited to be the liaison for IMS Global and the Post-Secondary Educational Standards Council.
Yeah, this is Chris from Spanish Alliance. I don't have a problem with Mark. I mean, he seems like he's got a lot of experience, but I am interested in talking to him. Maybe we could just have a special session or something where we talk about this as a particular thing, because I know that the majority of the folks joining the community group aren't as involved in higher ed and K-12. So I'm just really interested in getting involved in the discussion about how we're going to position this to IMS and, just being part of the conversation.
Yeah, great. So I think you have Mark's email address.
Yep.
And I think it would be good to maybe pull in, like ETS, Bill Gebert from ETS, and then maybe, Mary or Eric from Accreditrust as well, since all of you are involved in the that space, the education space. So certainly, I mean, and there's no reason we can't have more than one liaison, right? I mean, we can, if you wanted to have someone from Badge Alliance or the the OBI stuff participate and be a liaison, I think that's definitely doable. Maybe what we should do is what you just suggested is carve out a chunk of time on the next call to talk about how we're going to position this stuff to IMS Global and groups like the Post-Secondary Educational Standards Council. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, so we'll carve out time on the next call to talk about that stuff.
Thanks.
Okay, anything else? Go ahead, Tim.
Sorry, it's Tim Hoffman. I just wanted to note that I'm also working on trying to find some subject matter experts within the education space. They're not ready yet, and I guess I hope a multi-stakeholder, you know, a multitude of people could aid in that education process also.
Yep.
From around the world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I think we're a bit heavy on the Western world education system. We don't have as many people from Asia Pacific or Australia involved. I know IMS Global is a global standard setting organization, but it would be good to have people, you know, directly involved in, for example, Australia as well.
There's some fantastic work happening in New Zealand. However, I haven't had enough time to reach out to them as yet. So perhaps also a growth pattern and the ability to engage, so perhaps an engagement process or something. Perhaps even a subcommittee. Perhaps what we're talking about for the education space is someone that's chairing a subcommittee.
I guess my concern with that is we're going to end up duplicating work that the Badge Alliance is doing, because they have subcommittees on you know, education and stuff like that. Chris, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I think we're trying to keep the work here fairly narrow on technical standards for, you know, technical standards that meet the education and financial, you know, banking and government use cases, but actually having subcommittees, you know, might be something better handled by, especially in education, might be something better handled by the Badge Alliance.
Sorry, I was muted. Yeah, I agree. I mean, for the time being, at least, like, I don't want to. I don't want to say that we should only talk about that kind of stuff in Badge Alliance working groups, but we do have a bunch of structure around it. So, Tim, I mean, if you can't, check out badgealliance.org and look at some of the working groups we've got started there. My concern and the reason that I brought it up is just IMS is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to education standards. And they've, you know, they will get involved at some point. So I just want to be clear that, you know, how we approach them, I think, is important. And at some point, you know, maybe it does make sense to have an education subcommittee or something like that. But I agree with Manu. At this point, it doesn't feel right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we should certainly still pursue options like that. Tim, I mean, you should certainly still reach out and see if you can get folks involved.
I guess from the education standpoint, it's a groundswell, and it's starting to bear fruit. However, I still need to identify someone who's like a key technical contact that can help coordinate the interest within the education industry, you know, perhaps in Australia and New Zealand. So there's a bit of a sifting process, I guess, through trying to, you know, there's some major universities quite interested, in addition to some employment website type providers that have partnerships with some universities for their online education systems. But I'm not ready to nominate someone, if that makes sense, or to take that on. So I just think there's going to be significant interest within the education space for credentials, given the array of issues that emerge in that area without credentials. If that summarizes it. But too early. Yeah, it's too early to be able to engage with it right now, I believe. And Badge Alliance are very much do. I am aware of it, and there's a lot of excitement about that also. I think it's a very clear way of demonstrating the opportunity with credentials.
Okay. All right. Great. If there's nothing else on this topic, I mean, we're definitely going to, you know, we'll pick it back up next week, so we don't have to spend too much time on it. If there's nothing else on the topic, we can move on to the charter vote result. All right. Next up is the result of the charter vote. As many of you know, We held a two-week open vote on our charter. The results of that vote can be seen there. And basically, you know, we had decent turnout for the charter, considering how small this group is right now. It was unanimous pass of the charter. So we now have an operating charter. People can still object. We have, you know, anyone can object to the charter at any point. Anyone can provide a call for a vote to update the charter or change the charter at any time. So while we have an operating charter right now, the community is able to change it at any point by calling for a vote. And that doesn't mean that the community is going to vote for the changes, but I think what I'm trying to do is make it clear that just because we have a charter doesn't mean it is completely set in stone and unchangeable. The charter is meant to change with the needs of the community, and if we determine a need, we can extend the charter. I believe, Tim, you already have a set of additions or changes to the charter that you'd like. Please propose those on the mailing list. We'll have some discussion, and then when the group feels like we should vote on the additions, we'll hold another vote. Any questions on the charter? Go ahead.
With respect to those changes that I made in my Google Doc, should I just share a Google Doc so that way we can all edit it, or do you want to share a location to put the file that we can edit it? I'm thinking providing feedback. Perhaps we can have a collaborative doc that we can all edit.
So the Google Doc that you have, it's really hard for me, at least me personally, to pick out the changes that you made to it. There's no change tracking that I could see. So I don't know. You know, I don't know what changes you made. So maybe you know, refactoring it and saying, you know, add this one item, change this text to this text, and sending that to the mailing list might be easier for people. Would that work? Or I don't know if it's useful to have a collaborative doc on this, mainly because I think we might be able to do it on the mailing list. If it's a small set of changes, if it's a large set of changes, I agree that it should be a collaborative doc. But again, because I can't really tell how many changes were made to the charter, I don't know whether it should be a collaborative doc or just a couple of bullet items for changes.
In mine, the first one I pulled up in Google Docs, it's pretty clear. We'll take that offline. And we'll try and come up with something that works for everyone. Yeah.
Okay.
And feedback, obviously. So if you couldn't see the changes, you couldn't provide me feedback, which would have derailed the whole process. I'll come up with something to go on the list. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Any comments on the charter vote? Or any other comments? If not, we'll move on to the next agenda item. Okay. Last week, we started going through the web payments use case review. Let me find the link here. We got around halfway through the use case review last time, and so we're going to pick up the last one. Last use case we talked about was a pair executing a transaction without revealing secrets that are not vital to the transaction. Mary, I'm going to type this in here so you don't have to type it. Last time we covered this. So pair executes transaction without revealing secrets that are not vital to the transaction. For example, not sharing identity, passwords, PIN numbers, or other information like credit card numbers or date of birth, things like that. So we covered that. if you'll remember from last week, this is just a pass to go over the use cases and the design criteria. We will then come back through to talk about them in detail see if anyone has any concerns or issues with them. Let's try not to get too deeply into the technical discussion on these. Just as at a high level, do these use cases sound manageable or useful? Okay, so any questions before we continue to go through them?
I started looking at some use cases and stuck them on the list. Have you been able to see them at all?
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's the last agenda item that we have for today. If we get through these use cases, we'll pick those use cases up and talk about them, Tim.
Okay, cheers.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll go ahead and get started going through them. Keep in mind that these use cases came from the Web Payments Group and have already gone through two sets of review. So they've been reviewed and revised twice since May. It has taken way longer than we wanted it to, but it's they're better as a result of that. So the next up, we have what we're calling use cases and design criteria. The next up, a use case is basically something that you want a person to be able to do with the system that we're designing. A design criteria is more of we should heavily consider X, Y, and Z while building the solution. So this next one is a design criteria, which basically says consider using existing widely deployed identity provider mechanisms such as Facebook Connect, OpenID Connect, Google Plus Sign-In to integrate with the digital credential sharing and payment initiation process. Only invent a new mechanism if the current identity provider mechanisms do not provide the functionality necessary to achieve the use cases promoted by the group. So this basically means that, you know, if, for example, we really care about customer privacy, that using something like OpenID Connect might be problematic because the OpenID Connect provider can track every website that you're sending a credential to. Basically, they know which sites you're sending them to and can track you across the web. This is something that came up 2 weeks ago at the United Nations Internet Governance Forum. There was a lot of concern around privacy snooping. Any questions or concerns about what this design criteria means?
With that privacy mechanism that you're talking about, are we defining a mechanism to write some of the existing widely deployed identity provision mechanisms?
So the identity credential spec that we have right now covers both reading and writing in a private or a privacy protecting way. Now keep in mind that there's only so much privacy that you can have when you write a credential, right? Because you know who issued it. Your identity provider is going to know who issued it because of the digital signature on it.
So how is a user notified about the privacy circumstance in which they are operating?
It's an open question. We haven't had that discussion in the group yet. Other than important, other than saying it's important, we haven't said, you know, we haven't come up with a set of best practices on how that should be accomplished. One of the approaches could be what, you know, Google Plus does when you sign in or Twitter does when you sign in using them, or most OpenID Connect providers say when you use them is that, you know, these credentials are being transmitted. They can be used, you know, you're giving them the ability to always pull this information or just this instance to pull the information.
Is there a mechanism for providing a badge?
Perhaps
you can use open badge.
Well, yeah, badge and a credential are more or less interoperable terminology when it comes to the technology.
Right. Or a badge is just a subset of a credential. Badges are a subset of credentials.
Okay, so that design criteria makes sense. However, I think being able to create a distinction between the what perhaps data rights. It's one of the terms I use, the data safety, or I'm not sure what the best term is, but the qualities of the qualities of the mechanism. So whether one is a form that allows, you know, someone to be tracked all the time versus another that just allows them to be able to create that connection and then maintain serial anonymity. I think there's a distinction there.
Yep, agreed. And the data rights stuff really, you know, it's we haven't gotten to the data rights use cases, but I think many of us agree that we really should have some mechanism to express data rights with credentials.
Every you know, there's different types of authentication mechanisms, and they've got different qualities. So I think providing some sort of standard way of providing, you know, much like Creative Commons, creating some sort of way that a consumer, a lay consumer, a grandmother, can identify the difference between one authentication mechanism and another, you know, is an important part of the decision-making process of how a person chooses to use their identity credentials.
Yeah. Keep in mind that this design criteria is alluding to the notion that we could have a new login mechanism that we're working on, either this group or, you know, another group, to have a privacy protecting universal login mechanism on the web that enables the use of these credentials as login tokens. So you could go to a website and show them your digitally issued government passport or driver's license or, you know, some corporate credential that's been issued to get access rights to a website. So that's also kind of an open question here. The design criteria assumes that if we can't modify Facebook Connect or OpenID Connect to use these credentials to do login, that we could spawn a new login mechanism for the web.
I'm not sure that the potential requirement to create new authentication mechanisms versus the ability to describe which authentication mechanism the person is using that is compliant to the standard. I think they're two separate things. So a user may select to use Facebook Connect or OpenID or whatever they want, or OAuth 2, right? But at least they should, I think, is part of our specification how that integrates with digital credentials, providing the data back to the user about how that credential is going to be used. Yeah, how that mechanism. You get where I'm coming from? I'm saying
I think we're talking about three kind of separable things here, right? One of them is data rights, which is, I think, what you're talking about, right? The other one is how do credentials integrate with legacy login systems like OpenID Connect and Facebook Connect and Google Plus Sign In, right? And then the third one is there a way to use credentials for login? So I think those are, and we should really keep those separate, because once we start jumbling them together, it's going to be really hard to talk about it.
I'd agree with you. I also note that WebID isn't mentioned there.
Yep. So WebID is in the class.
Actually, WebID TLS. So to be more particular.
Right. Yep. Okay. Anything else on this design criteria before we move on? Okay. Next up is a use case. The use case is transact with the merchant without revealing any identifying information. Identifying information is available to the payment processor. This basically means that you can do an anonymous transaction with the merchant. But you ensure that the payment system ensures to stay within the regulatory framework, because the payment processor knows who you are. So basically, the payment processor has KYC'd you, or the bank has KYC'd you if the bank's operating as a payment processor. Any questions on this use case?
From memory, there's an issue with the receipt. So does the transaction incorporate the receipt?
That's correct. There is a digital receipt, and there are privacy implications for the digital receipt. For example, if the receipt that the merchant gets back has your name spelled out in your identity URL or your email address, then it's an accidental violation of privacy. So that needs to be considered in achieving this use case.
Right, and there are various implementation details that can solve that by obfuscating account URLs and things like that specifically for anonymous purchases.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. And specifically, when we say anonymous purchase, we mean when you go up and buy a candy bar or a magazine, or an under $10,000 transaction, something that's not required to be reported, or something that a purchase that is fairly benign. You should be able to, communicate with the merchant in a pseudo anonymous way.
I heard you on the there was a some sort of web radio thing that you spoke at an hour and a half or something like that, and within that you were talking about. Yeah, that's correct. You were talking about paying a website 5 cents, for example,
mm-hmm.
as a contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Does that need a separate use case?
I think that's that falls more into the web payments group. So paying a website 5 cents is more of a payments thing and not necessarily a credentials thing. Well,
okay.
I guess the question to you is, is there an aspect of credentials that you think this group should look at with the micropayments use cases in web payments?
I'd imagine that even if it's a 0.0001 of a cent, if it's a super micropayment, then there's still an identity element to it.
Yeah,
I believe that there quite likely is.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is also about the commerciality of how credentials might be commercialized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if there's a transaction fee of 5 cents, to be able to use your credentials. I'm not saying that's part of our standard, but if we're not taking that into consideration,
mm-hmm.
Then making a 5 cent transaction to contribute to some sort of website or whatever will be prohibitive from a transactional
mm-hmm.
basis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't imagine that you wouldn't be able to do that without declaring who you are. You wouldn't be able to give them any money. Are you able to give them any money?
I mean, certainly with the specs that we have right now, you can give people money without identifying who you are to the merchant. The payment processor still knows who you are. But like Dave Longley said, there are many ways to obfuscate your identity to the merchant. And then the merchant can decide
KYC at the floor limit?
It depends on the country. So it depends.
Right.
It depends on the set of regulations operating in the country, and they're a fairly wide set of regulations. But there's not, you can say that cash is pseudo-anonymous, and that people go walk into convenience stores every single day and do pseudo-anonymous transactions with merchants. If you pay in cash, that's effectively what you're doing.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Any questions about the pseudo-anonymous transaction use case?
Hey, Manu, this is Pat. Maybe just a question, and I'm still coming up to speed, so forgive me if this is a newbie question, but it sounds like some of the conversations that are kind of happening are revolving around transactions. There's a couple different kinds of transactions, some which require strong identity to be passed
mm-hmm.
through them, so buying a car with cash, for example, you need
mm-hmm.
to pass probably some identifiable elements to the merchant. And then there's other transactions that these are really attributes of the transactions that
mm-hmm.
maybe consumer choice that they choose to or choose not to allow, you know, elements of their identity to be passed through the credential that they happen to be using.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good way of thinking about this, and that, you know, the identity itself is kind of this core thing that, you know, belongs ultimately to the consumer, and then there's a credential mechanism which then allows, you know, potentially some of that identity to be exposed in certain scenarios, and in others just totally prevented from being exposed. Am I tracking that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. That's spot on. Yep. Yeah, and I think that the technologies, at least that we have right now, allow that to happen. What we're trying to do is, you know, make sure that the use cases exist where we try to explain to people what the scenarios are, where you would, you know, in one scenario you'd have to give all of your information, all your personally identifying information, or a good chunk of it, for KYC, for example, and in other cases you shouldn't have to give hardly any of it, if any of it, over to the merchant.
I was just going to say, all this technology is designed such that you only have to provide the minimum amount of identifying information in order to complete a transaction. If you want to optionally give more information than that, then that's fine. The technology should permit that as well.
Yeah, I guess the challenge, though, maybe is that you know, the folks that are actually issuing the identities today, the incentives are such that they still know, and that feels like maybe one of the use cases here is that, you know, as a consumer, you know, are there ways of actually maintaining my identity in a manner which allows me to me as the consumer to associate that with a number of different credential providers without having to, you know, rely on those credential providers exclusively to be the owners of my identity. And so, like Facebook Connect, right? They own that instance of Pat, right? They own, you know. So if I use that credential somewhere else, that's a specific instance. But I don't have a way to easily personally affiliate, you know, that information that I choose to give them as a consumer, if that makes sense.
Right. So all of the technologies that we're creating here, because it's happening at the World Wide Web Consortium, are completely consumer focused. Meaning that the entity that has the final say over how that credential can be used is the person who is the person. So, for example, if you get a government issued digital passport, that credential is given to you. You keep it in your personal data store online, and then you decide when that is transmitted to a third party. Now, the organization that provided that credential to you could still kind of transmit it around, but the key here is that it's the consumer that decides when and how much of their personal information is shared with a merchant or third party. Does that make sense? So I guess what I'm trying to say is we're trying to make sure that this is not a like corporation-centric identity mechanism where you have these credentials that only exist with these other corporations. We're trying to make this more like your wallet, where you have multiple forms of identity in your wallet, and you choose where to store that information and who you give that information to.
Yes, I think also
it's a whole movement around what's called Rewrite Web or cloud storage that is noted in Tim Berners-Lee's design notes. I'll just design issues rather. So I'll just post that into the IRC. I've also posted a manuscript by Andre, which is about decentralized storage and how linked data can allow a person to store their own data, as opposed to the way some of the current silos work. So tell me if I'm wrong, Manu, but I think part of this work is also a bit more flexible about how some of the data patterns work. Is that a good way of describing it?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I mean, we're trying to affect a lot of consumer choice here on where they store their credentials and how, and they get to say how their credentials are used. versus the way it's kind of done today online, which is, you know, the corporation that assigns you the credential, you know, gives you, you know, you have to go to the corporation to tell them to transmit it to someone else, and that's not necessarily privacy protecting, because all of a sudden that corporation then knows where you're logging into, what information you're giving to what other organizations online, and, you know, and then bundles that information and sells it. Pat, did that make sense? I think we're kind of, there's a lot of stuff that we're pulling into this, but does what we're saying make sense? Do you have any other questions on it?
No, actually, this is very helpful. I mean, and actually, I was asking the question more because I was hoping that you guys would say what you just said, right? I mean, I think that's one of the challenges that we have today is, you know, even in the corporate world, you know, portability of identity across organizations, and then, you know, being, I'll call maybe what I would call kind of delegated authorization. So, you know, the permission of some organization to be able to use that, you know, identity as part of a transaction or part of a part of a contract with another entity on behalf of the organization. That's a dynamic that I think might, you know, ultimately be down the road for this. But it's good to know that we're focused really on that core identity and how to make that, you know, pluggable and transportable and you know, basically allowing the person to say, I'm willing to give my identity information to, you know, Corporation X to be able to do, you know, certain functions or features or transactions with them.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
It's
right.
Tim Holman. I think everyone has the right to identity and persona. And I think they're two distinct different things. And for legal purposes, obviously, any account that might store your data that might be accessible by web applications that can acquire that data from a storage location that holds your own data on behalf of you would require identity at the core of it. But then, you know, depending on how you want to interact with different services, whether that's sending a registered email to someone else with a priority date, these sorts of things require the underlying identity factor without necessarily requiring you to use identity for all your data. And, of course, you have different relationships with different entities. I hope that helps.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you, guys. And the links are helpful, too. Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay, if there's nothing else on the pseudo-anonymous transaction with the merchant use case, we'll go to the next one. Okay, next use case is one that we at least decided in the web payments group to not put into the version 1 of the technology, meaning that this is a use case that I believe we're rejecting for version 1. The use case is enable truly anonymous transactions such that the identity of the payee is not discoverable by payee's merchants or payment processors. This is basically, you know, untraceable cash online. And the reason that we rejected this use case is we do not believe it is technically feasible to do this today. We think we don't think it's one technically feasible, and we don't think it fits into the regulatory frameworks for most countries. So the idea that you could make a $50,000 payment truly anonymously runs afoul of all kinds of regulatory, you know, issues. Now, this was a use case that was raised at the W3C Web Payments Workshop. But again, I mean, this really has to do with having true anonymity online. And for the credentials, you know, case, I think we already support a decent bit of pseudo-anonymity. Like on last week's call, we said that we have to be really careful about saying true anonymity and pseudo-anonymity, and that we don't believe true anonymity is possible given the current architecture of the Internet and the web, right? Because you have an IP address, it can be tracked down, you know, to a geographic location, you know, all those kinds of things. You know, you have GPS, all these things kind of work against this claim to have fully anonymous anything. So I think what we're saying is that we should definitely never say that we can support true anonymity. And the best that we can do is say that we support pseudo-anonymity. And then we only support pseudo-anonymity when it fits into, you know, the regulatory frameworks inside the countries in which you're operating the technology. Any questions about this use case? Go ahead.
Have a best practice pseudo-anonymity.
Yep. Yeah, best practice is we can't claim true anonymity because the technology is not there to do it.
Yeah, we just support varying degrees of pseudo-anonymity, I guess is the best way for us to put it.
Yep. So maybe that should change into a design criteria. We'll come back to it later, but unless there are any objections to what was just said, you know, what Dave Longley just said, which is we support various levels of pseudo-anonymity and specifically not true anonymity. If there are no objections, we'll move on to
that. I think the difference between varying levels is how do you know which level? So given that people will be picking this stuff up and won't be educated in it as they're reading some of the requirements, there's a difference between what is lawfully capable and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's essentially what we're trying to define in effect.
Yeah, it's we still don't know how to best communicate, you know, the data rights issue or the anonymity versus pseudo-anonymity issue.
Yeah, understood.
Okay, next use case is one, let's see, well, yeah. Use case is Jack, a payer, wants to send Jill a payee some money and asks Jill for a short, memorable payment identifier. Jill sends the payment identifier to Jack via SMS message. Jack makes a payment using the short payment identifier. The payment processor translates the short payment identifier into a destination financial account for Jill. So, for example, Jill could say, I'm going to type this out, Mary. Could say SMS text. So basically, Jill could send a short SMS text to Jack saying, send $5 to Tilda Jill Jackson. Basically, Jack could put that into his payment client, and Jill Jackson would be expanded out into some kind of actual identifier, like a URL that the payment could be sent to using a REST API. This was a use case that was brought up by Ripple Labs at the W3C Web Payments Workshop. It's unclear. There's another use case here. Let's see. Which story? The next use case in the list also concerns this. It's this idea of a short identifier that can be associated with a financial account. And it requires kind of a new protocol for discovering these short payment identifiers. And it's also, we're also wondering whether or not this should be a version 2 feature, meaning that, you know, without all the version 1 stuff in place, the version 2 stuff can't really without the base level version 1 stuff, the version 2 stuff is, you know, questionable on whether or not it's useful. The other open question is, you know, if we create this, you know, short payment identifier expansion mechanism, it sounds like a new internet protocol or a new web protocol to do discovery on this. And there is work happening elsewhere to do this. Say again?
Is this design requirement about HTTP or is it about a third party network of some form?
It's not about HTTP. It's about a new type of identifier on the web that's effectively like a decentralized identifier that's a short identifier that anyone can claim and map to another URI, like an HTTP URL or something of that nature.
Those are like URI aliases or something?
Yeah.
Well, probably Hevish first should consider long identifiers. So all the data that we need to process payment like this.
What was the first sentence you said? What kind of identifier?
The first sentence is first we have to consider long identifiers. I mean, all the data needed to process this payment. It can be account number, it can be a lot of other stuff that are specific to payment system. So probably the short identifiers really should go to version 2, but version 1 can consider the receiver's credentials and well, the account credentials probably or something like this. So all the data that we really need to put the money to.
Right. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So version 1 focuses on the basic identifiers that we need, like URLs for accounts or, you know, whatever. And then in version 2, we can say, okay, now we can shorten those identifiers to things like email addresses or, short text strings.
Yeah, or maybe create some procedure how to create short identifier from long one.
Right. Yep. Okay, we're out of time for the. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The use of SMS message, in particular, I would suggest that perhaps some other way of describing that is not HTTP.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the distinction is that you're creating a short identifier that can be used on a network that is not a HTTP type communication medium. It could be a letter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It could be all sorts of different things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we need to discuss this a bit more deeply to see whether or not we actually want to try and tackle this in the version 1 of the work.
And it should also not be payment identifier. It should be an identifier or credential identifier.
Right. Yeah. It should just be an identifier. Like I said, you know, this needs to be generalized if we're going to get any traction with it at W3C.
Agreed.
Okay. We're out of time today. Thank you, everyone, for joining the call. We'll have another call next week at the same time and day of week. Anything we should be aware of before the call next week?
Feedback on those use cases I started would be fantastic if anybody has time.
Yep. Yeah, we should definitely respond
to those.
Hey, Manu, what's the best way of sending feedback on those use cases?
Just respond to the mailing list.
Okay.
I can. Is this Pat?
Yep.
Okay, Pat. There's. I can send you the link. In each. Let me give you the links here really quickly. So there's this one, and there is this one that Tim sent out. These are Tim's use cases. Do you mean the Tim's use cases or the wiki use cases?
Just in general. I just wanted to ask if the mailing list is the best way to kind of send these things out.
Mailing list is the best place.
Okay,
yep.
Perfect.
And the emails that I linked to there, there's a link somewhere in there called Mail Actions, and it says respond to this message. If you click on that, it should open up your email client and properly thread the message in the response. You do need to be in the credentials community group to respond. Otherwise, it's going to send you an email and say, hey, you're not in the group. You need to agree to the community license agreement, which basically says anything that you say on the mailing list, it becomes a part of the group's work. Make sense?
Yep, it does. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right, thanks, everyone, and we'll chat next week. Thanks, bye.
Cheers, stay well.
Thanks.
Bye.